Luke chapter 12, one of Jesus' parables, and we'd be skipping to other parts of the Bible just to cross-reference this morning. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God. Can I take you back to the 16th century, the days of the Reformation? Great Britain, especially England, was going through vast changes. Power was being centralized more and more in the government. The economy was booming. And wool was the new product. And in order to find greater wealth, in order to develop the economy, land, more and more land was being seized for putting sheep to graze on. It was called the enclosures. Land that had traditionally been common land for the poor to graze the odd sheep or cow on, was being fenced off so that the richer people could increase their property, could increase their portfolio. A number of people were writing on the economy at that time, and they blamed the state of the nation on the greed of nobles, clergy, landlords, gentry, and great merchants of various kinds. Sounding vaguely familiar to me anyway. In the midst of all that, one of the court chaplains stood up and preached. His name was Hugh Latimer, and the king was King Edward, the young King Edward. And Latimer preached one of the great sermons of all time. The title and theme of the sermon was "Beware Greed, Which is Idolatry," in which he let fly at the enclosures, at the way the poor were being treated and kicked off their lands. Sadly, neither he nor the king were to live for very long. The king died shortly afterwards of consumption, and Latimer was burnt at the stake in a subsequent reign of the Queen Mary, or Bloody Mary, as she is known. Would Hugh Latimer preach the same sermon today if he were to get the opportunity to preach in the House of Commons or Lords? I wonder. Knowing Latimer, I think the answer would be yes. And he wouldn't need to change very much. As I was researching for this, I came across Barack Obama blaming greed and irresponsibility for our current problems. Senator John McCain also blamed greed, excess and corruption in his campaign, so he didn't have that much choice if you're an American. They both blamed the same thing. Even, of course, Lula, the socialist Brazilian president, complained about the boundless greed of a few, and both Brown and Cameron had something to say, but I started Googling and lost the will to live and gave up. Greed, which is idolatry. Even the Times today, if you buy a copy of the Times or read it online, find an article from Minette Martin, which she says there's something about being extremely rich that blurs ordinary perspective in all but the most exceptional people. So they are in the Times as well. It's the buzzword of the moment. Of course, Jesus was there first. You knew that. He would be, wouldn't he? And he tells the story. He tells the story about greed. It sparked off by a man coming to him, asking him to tell his brother off for not dividing the inheritance. Now, deciding who got the inheritance was the job of the scribes. It was their official job. They were kind of like the lawyers of the day. So it really wasn't Jesus' job to decide that at all, which is why Jesus says, is it my job to do that? There are lawyers around who do that kind of thing. It wasn't Jesus' job to do that. And in Jesus' day, what would happen would be the farm, the property, would pass to the elder son. And the younger son would get nothing or get as much as the older brother decided to pass on. But there was no law that could make the elder brother divide the inheritance. He would only do so if he wished. And he didn't wish in this case. And the man was furious and upset and comes to Jesus to get his hands on part of the estate. And of course it was nothing to do with Jesus. It was for the lawyers to decide. But Jesus says, well, as you ask, let me tell you something. Beware of all kinds of greed, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Beware of greed. Well, what is greed? Graham Tomlin, in his book Seven Deadly Sins, talks about greed. He calls it avarice. Avarice is just a posh word for greed. Okay? Greed or avarice takes over when I begin to imagine that my needs are the only one that matter, and I don't have to balance my needs with those of anyone else. Greed, which is idolatry, says Paul in Colossians 3:5. Greed, which is in all the headlines. Of course, there was that famous film a while back, called Wall Street, with Michael Douglas' character, Gordon Gekko is the character in the film, extolling the virtues of greed. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, he says that greed, for lack of better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, greed for money, greed for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save our company, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Well, it was a film, and a good one. But greed has been denounced. Greed is now the cause which we're all denouncing. But Jesus was there first. And he tells a story. I've read the story so often, you know, I come back to it to preach on it. But I try to step back and look at it afresh. And I said, what is it in this story that it's about? No, it's about a rich man. And he does very well. It rains in his allotment. And he gets all this food, and he gets all he gets all this wealth. And so what does he do? Well, he stores it up and takes early retirement. And I'm thinking, what's he done wrong? Because in our society, that is perfectly acceptable conduct. Put your money somewhere safe and take early retirement. He's not done anything wrong by the standards of our modern society. But yet Jesus calls him a fool. So what's he done wrong? Where is the point at which prudence becomes greed? I've got a pension fund. Still, for the moment. I belong to one of the few final salary pension schemes left in the country, and I really don't think it will be there by the time I come to retire. But for the moment, anyway, by God's grace, I've been saving up my salary for getting on for 40 years now, so that I will carry on with a little bit of money when I retire. It's prudence, and I don't feel bad about that. I don't think that's greed. I think that's common sense. I don't want my children to have to support me. My daughter's a nurse, so I hardly expect her to support me when I'm retired. So what's wrong in putting it aside? What's this man done wrong? At what point does prudence become greed? Or take the banks. It used to be that relatively poor people like you and me, or middle class people like you and me, or whatever, we used to want to buy a house. So we'd go to the bank, and the bank would say, not a problem, we'll lend you money, and you pay it back to us with a small charge, a small interest rate on top, and after 25 years, you will own your own house. And we were all happy with that. The banks were happy, they were making money. We were getting to own a house. That's how my parents bought their house. What point did it become greed? Well, that's interesting. Because in the 90s, the American banks invented what they called securitization. Basically, they realized that pension funds and investors were looking for solid investments for their large amounts of money. And they realized that they could sell mortgages onto them. So that these funds would then have a steady income for 20-odd years, which was very attractive to the funds. And the banks realized they could do that and sell the mortgages on at a profit. So basically, the banks would sell you and me a mortgage, and then sell the mortgage on to somebody else. And that was going to get dodgy, you see, because they realized they could just keep a turnover. Well, to keep the money turning over, what they needed was to sell more mortgages. So who could they sell mortgages to? They were selling to people like us, but they wanted more. They wanted to make more profit, sell more mortgages on. Who could they sell a mortgage to who didn't have a mortgage? Think hard. No good selling it to a Latin American regime, because they'd done that in the 70s and it went pear-shaped. Who were they going to sell it to? Lights come on. Sell mortgages to poor people. No one had ever done that. So they began selling mortgages to poor people. They gave it a different name. They called it the subprime market. And all across America, they began selling mortgages to poor people. They did it in Britain too. Somebody from our church once, back in the end of the 90s, were given a 105% mortgage, and neither of them had a secure job. And the mortgages were passed on and sold off, and the whole thing came crashing down. At which point did prudence become greed? Well, it became greed there and then, didn't it? I was reading in New Statesman last October. It said that the Treasury Minister, Yvette Cooper, entered into despair when she discovered that Northern Rock had hived off £50 billion worth of mortgages to a Jersey-based company called Granite, registered as a charity benefiting Down syndrome children in the northeast of England. That's what was going on. It's called greed. Prudence became greed. At what point does prudence become greed in your life and mine? Well, I think it becomes different, because the greed that beset Great Britain and most of the Western world, but I think Britain was probably one of the worst, was not the greed to save, but the greed to spend, and to spend more than you actually had, spend it on credit. To me, the symbol of greed was seen in Britain recently on a TV documentary I saw, following the misfortunes of a family being evicted by bailiffs from their house and ringing up the council and effing and blinding the council officials because they wanted to be housed immediately. And I went through their history. They bought their council house for £40,000 from the council, and then remortgaged it so often that their debt was now £120,000. It didn't say what they spent the money on, but you could guess what they spent the money on. Consumer items. Prudence, careful financial management had become greed. It can happen so easily, and it's happened so often in our consumer-driven society. And I don't know if any of you are fans of Lily Allen. She's a bad girl, but she's a great lyricist. I know some of you listen to Radio 1 and 2 because you've got that glazed look in your eyes. And Lily Allen's a bad girl, but she's a wonderful lyricist. And this is her latest single. It's called The Fear. I have to bleep out some of the words, but I will. I want to be rich and I want lots of money, she says. I don't care about clever and I don't care about funny. I want loads of clothes and bleep loads of diamonds. I heard people die while they're trying to find them. Life's about film stars and less about mothers. It's all about fast cars and cussing each other. But it doesn't matter, because I'm packing plastic. And that's what makes my life so bleeping fantastic. And then comes my favourite line. Isn't this is superb. And I am a weapon of massive consumption. And it's not my fault. It's how I'm programmed to function. I think that is just the most amazing line. A weapon of massive consumption. If ever there was a definition of the people of Great Britain today, she's got it like that. Isn't that superb? We are a weapon of massive consumption. But then the chorus, because she's good, the chorus goes this. I don't know what's right and what's real anymore. And I don't know how I'm meant to feel anymore. When do you think it will all become clear? Because I'm being taken over by the fear. That's brilliant. Weapons of massive consumption. Archbishop John Sentamu, Archbishop of York, said, "We have all worshipped this idol. No one is guiltless. Greed, which is idolatry. God's grace doesn't depend on a FTSE index. Greed, which is idolatry." Avarice, says Peter Kreeft, is not desire as much as such for temporal possessions, but the immoderate desire for them. For it is natural to desire external things as means, but greed makes them into ends, into gods. And when a creature is made into a god, it becomes a devil. Jim Wallace said, prudent investments has been replaced with reckless financial gambling in a casino economy. And the benefits accruing to top chief executive officers and financial managers, especially as compared to the declining wages of average workers, has become one of the great moral travesties of our time. One half of all the profits made on Wall Street recently, the big boom, were paid out in bonuses and salaries to staff. Jesus said, listen, when you start living as if you alone are on the planet, then you are being overtaken by greed. Nothing wrong in making money, but says Jesus, when the whole point of the money becomes you, then you have been overtaken by greed. And as Paul says, greed is idolatry. So what's the cure for it? Well, let's unpack what Jesus says. The Apostle Paul at one point unpacks what Jesus meant. Let's take another look at another Bible passage. Let's move to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Let's take a look at verses 6 and 7. Where Paul says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. One of the great images of this past year, and you've all seen them, was that the crash of that plane in the Hudson River in America. Isn't it the most haunting image of the passengers standing on the wing of that plane? As it floats in the Hudson River. Isn't that just an amazing image? All those people standing there in the middle of this freezing water, standing safe on the wing of this aeroplane. It's an amazing picture. At that moment, it didn't matter to them if they were packing plastic. At that moment, they were stripped of every MasterCard, every checkbook, every overdraft facility. Their designer underpants and their Rolex watches at that point didn't matter. Their property portfolio and their pension fund were worth nothing at that moment. All that mattered was that they were safe. Their life had been spared. That's all that mattered to them at that precise moment. We brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of it, says Paul. Everything we have is on loan. All the money we carry in our wallets will one day belong to somebody else. It's just passing through our hands. It's on loan. Ultimately, it's God. John Wesley said, there is one way to avoid greed, and there is no other under heaven. If those who gain all they can and save all they can will likewise give all they can, then the more they gain, the more they will grow in grace, and the more treasure they will lay up in heaven. There's a famous bumper sticker in America, reputedly taken from a comment by Malcolm Forbes, the economist, but I'm not sure that's true. Nobody really knows the origin of it. But it says, the one who dies with most toys wins. Of course, it's nonsense. It's meant to be nonsense. It's not true, is it? For we brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of it, says Paul. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, says Jesus. We have all worshipped at this altar, says John Sintamo. If God is my delight, then I can live on less. Let's take a look at verses 6 to 8 now. Let's put those up on the screen. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. There is an American writer called Irma Bombeck. I see her quoted quite often. She's not known in this country very well. But she writes mainly about children, which is why I kind of tend to pick up on it. She writes this about an 8-year-old girl called Christina. Christina is suffering from cancer. On her 8th birthday, she's asked what she wants for her birthday. Christina thinks for a while, and finally she says, I don't know. I have 2 sticker books and a Cabbage Patch doll. I have everything. But if we have food and clothing, says Paul, we will be content with that. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, says Jesus. And then finally, we need to be as generous as God. Let's take a look at verses 17 and 18 of that same chapter. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. To be generous and willing to share. There are lots of obnoxious rich people in the world. There are a lot of obnoxious poor people in the world. There are no obnoxious generous people in the world. We may be economically strapped for cash, but we can still be generous. The most hospitable and most generous people I've ever worked with were a group of poor, landless people in Brazil. Now, you can react to this how you like. You can listen to Thomas Aquinas, the great theologian of the Middle Ages. It is a sin directly against one's neighbour, greed, since one man cannot overabound in external riches without another man lacking them. It is a sin against God, just as all mortal sins, inasmuch as man condemns things eternal for the sake of temporal things. One man cannot abound in riches without another man lacking them, said Thomas Aquinas. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, says Jesus. Greed, which is idolatry, says Paul. We have all worshipped it. No one is guiltless, says the Archbishop of York. Anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God is a fool, says Jesus. Now, I don't know, I guess you've been following the headlines, haven't you? And haven't you been morally outraged? Doesn't it feel good to be indignant? Doesn't it feel good when some scumbag makes you look good? Admit it. Yeah? This guy wrecks a bank, takes it down, to the extent that each man, woman and child in the UK is going to have to fork out £300 to save this bank. And he walks off with a £17 million bonus pension. Oh, didn't you feel outraged by that? Didn't it feel good to be outraged? Didn't you just say to yourself, well, the scumbag, just look at that. Look at him. Just look at him. Keeping to himself all those riches while the rest of us pay, or the rest of us go miserable. What a miserable man. What a guy who deserves to be in a dungeon. And just imagine for a moment, somewhere in Africa, there's an AIDS orphan, and she's sitting on the doorstep of her house, contemplating giving her body to prostitution in order to have enough money to say, to look after her two younger sisters who she's caring for. And just imagine that she's given a telescope that looks straight into your house, straight into your bank account. What's she saying as she's looking at your life and mine? Is she saying, the scumbag? Look at all they've got and look how little they give. Just look at all that they're accruing and spending. Just look, they just don't give anything away, do they? How would your life and mine look from that perspective? I hope you've enjoyed looking down your nose at a very rich banker and his ilk. Because at that point, Jesus looks at you and says, well, just make sure that when Jesus says, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God, just make very sure that Jesus isn't looking straight at you when he says it.